The rack tonight. My name is Dave Black. I'm the chairman of the Southern Region. I'm from St. George. I'd like to start down on my far left, and we'll introduce the rack. So we'll start with Craig.
Craig Laubach, Culture.
Mac Morrill, Bicknell Agriculture.
Sean Kelly, Fillmore, Forest Service.
Rusty Aiken, Cedar City, at large.
Kevin Bunnell, Division of Wildlife, Southern Region.
Nick Jorgensen, out of St. George, non-consumptive.
Dale Bagley from Marysville, elected official.
Braden Richmond from Beaver, sportsman.
Gene Boardman Hinckley, at large.
Okay, we'd also like to recognize two of our board members here tonight. We have Steve Dalton and Donnie Hunter. Welcome. Appreciate your attendance. The first action item that we have is the acceptance of the agenda and the minutes. I assume you've had an opportunity to read through the agenda and the minutes from last time. Okay, we have a motion to accept the minutes and a second from Rusty. All in favor? Okay, that carries unanimous. Thank you. Wildlife Board update. I can say that the Wildlife Board meeting was a lot more interesting than our last RAC meeting that we had. The audience was filled with special interest groups that were against increasing the number of tags for cougars. And I don't know how many comment cards there were, but there's over 30 or so, I would imagine. All the news channels were there, and we heard from all these groups how we don't need to increase or kill any more cougars in the state. So it was a very interesting meeting. There's a strong contingency out there that is really against hunting cougars, and we heard from most of those. But what I can report on is that the board went along fairly closely to what came out of the Southern RAC. If you recall, we had recommended increases of cougars in a couple areas as far as tags go, permits go. And the board went along almost exactly in line with what came out of the Southern RAC. So that they do listen to us, we appreciate them and their comment, and we appreciate you guys and the discussions that we had. And maybe Kevin might have a little bit more to say on that meeting too, but we'll turn the time over to him for an update.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Seeing as how we don't have a lot of public here, I'm going to kind of high grade my update a little bit with the things that I think that you guys will be most interested in. From the wildlife section, Teresa and Jason attended last week what's called the Wild Horse and Burro Advisory Board in Elko, and they were there representing the whole state and spoke in behalf of the state in terms of managing wild horses. There were some Tammy Pearson from Beaver County was there as well and expressed a lot of appreciation for Teresa and Jason being there helping bring that message. That's a tough one. But there's the pressure seems to be mounting, and hopefully, if anything's going to be resolved, it'll have to be done probably through Congress, and we'll see what happens. But it's I think there's more. The drum beats louder right now on that issue than it has been in a long time. So we'll see if it breaks something loose. Just for your guys' information, in case you have kids or grandkids that you want to take out, the youth chucker hunt is this Saturday, and we'll be releasing birds in the usual spots. There's usually some on the Parowan Gap. There's some out on our WMAs in Millard County. There's birds released in Sevier County. They're west of or east of Richfield. And there's information on all the sites, I believe, Phil, on the website on where we're going to be releasing birds. And then the following Saturday is the general chucker hunt, and we'll also be releasing birds in similar locations for that. And then on that same note, our pheasant releases will continue on our wildlife management units, similar to the way they've gone the last couple of years. Starting in November, we'll be releasing birds on the WMAs. Habitat section, probably the biggest news right now is the various fires that we have going on around the state. The fire here on the Beaver Mountain is referred to as the Briggs Fire. So far, has been a very positive fire for wildlife. The report that we got just recently was the outer circumference of it or boundary covers about 7,000 acres, but there's only about 2,000 acres that are actually burned within that perimeter. So it's kind of a spotty, slow-moving fire, and it'll probably do a lot of good for wildlife. And while we've got the district ranger here, I want to publicly thank the Forest Service for the way they've worked with us on that fire. When it started, Richard, our aquatics manager, got really nervous because we have a population of Bonneville cutthroat trout that was just below where that fire started in a tributary. And the Forest Service provided the manpower, and with the assistance of our biologists, we went in and shocked that stream and collected about 200 of those fish, which we think was most of them, and moved them to another place where they're not in danger of that fire. And so that allowed the forest to manage that fire to do some good, and at the same time we were able to protect a fish population that's pretty important to us. So that's the way things are supposed to work, and they worked right in this situation. So thank you. Law enforcement, obviously this is a pretty busy time, the busiest time of year for our officers, and they've been being kept busy. We do have a new officer in Millard County, Curtis Shumway. He's only a rookie in name. He actually has about 9 years of experience with a local police department up in Cache Valley, and then moved over. So he's an experienced officer and is hitting the ground with a lot more experience than normal, and he'll do very, very well. You know, one thing that's been a little disappointing this time of year, the law enforcement guys use a decoy to help patrol. And they've put it out six or seven times so far. They've had five people that have shot at it after dark, which, you know, that happens. But the disappointing part to me is that two or three of those have been dads and moms with young kids with them, hunting with them at the same time. And that, you know, that's pretty disappointing that they'd do that with their kids with them and just. Anyway, they were all pretty embarrassed, and I don't think they'll do it again. But the fact that it happened in the first place is a little disheartening. In our aquatic section, a lot going on. There has over the summer, just by for announcement, the Fish Lake Perch Tournament will happen again this winter. I think it's the last or the second to last Saturday in January. The last Saturday, which what did we decide? The 28th, January 28th. Gunlock Reservoir. If you remember, we treated that reservoir last winter. It's now been restocked and doing well. Sometimes we have to do a 2-year process, but we felt like we had a really good treatment with 1 year, and we've already got fish back in Gunlock. Fall fishing is just starting to pick up. Richard's hearing good reports from Panguitch Lake and Minersville. And Lake Powell, the water temperatures are coming down, and fish are starting to get really active again at Lake Powell. So a good time to be out enjoying that. Just in our admin section, we've got some new faces at our front desk. If you come into the office, Gianni, that worked with us and has been here at the racks with us for, how many years did Gianni work for us, Natalie? Almost 10 years. She applied for a job with State Parks, which was a promotion for her, and was successful in obtaining that position. So she's still within the Department of Natural Resources, but is over with State Parks now. And we've hired Mindy Cox full-time. She's been working part-time at our front desk for a while. And just to make things a little more complicated during one of the busiest times of year, Stephanie, who's the other person, the other one that you'll recognize, and has been here in these meetings, just had knee surgery. So she's been out, or be out for 2 or 3 weeks. So some new faces at the front desk if you come in, but they're doing well. That's about all I have. Conservation Outreach, Phil, is anything you want to add? I think Phil introduced himself last time, but I'm going to introduce him again formally. Phil Tuttle has taken Lynn Chamberlain's spot as our Conservation Outreach Manager. Phil came to us through what was was the most in-depth interview process we've ever done in the agency. We had almost 150 people apply for that job. We started with an interview. We interviewed almost 30 people the first round and narrowed it down from there. And I can... When Phil applied, he was only interested in the southern region, which made it easy for me because there were three positions that were open. We hired the position in our southeastern region, southern region, and northeastern region, and all of the other supervisors would have taken Phil first if they would have had the chance, but they didn't. And so we've got him here, and we're lucky to have him. So we'll you'll see some changes in that program over the next several years as he hits the ground running. So. With that, Dave. Oh, one other thing. I've been asked by a couple of the RAC members about the meeting that I attended and missed the RAC meeting, and I think it was in July. I was attending a meeting down in Mexico on the Mexican Wolf Recovery Project. My role on that committee is to make sure that the Fish and Wildlife Service follows their own rules in terms of keeping reintroductions within the historic range of that species, which is well south of the state of Utah. Early in the process, there was some interest being expressed in moving Mexican wolf recovery up into southern Utah and southern Colorado. So far, we've successfully pushed back on that, and part of that is because the Mexican government has engaged and is willing to take part in that effort to the conservation effort for Mexican wolves, which is appropriate because literally 90% of the range of that species was within the state of Mexico. About 10% of it, or the country of Mexico, about 10% of it came up into southern Arizona and southern New Mexico, and there's an active program going on there as well. But with the engagement of the Mexican government, right now all the recovery efforts are focused south of I-40, which is about where the Mogollon Rim starts in Arizona, if you're familiar with Arizona, about halfway up the state. That process isn't complete. I'll be back down in Tucson in November and then back in Mexico again in February to finish that process. But as of now, I think we're in pretty good shape. So unless anybody has any questions.
Which species is that?
The Mexican wolf, which is a subspecies of wolves. No, they look very similar. They're a little bit smaller than the northern wolves. They evolved with coos deer and javelina, so smaller prey base than elk and moose and caribou that the northern wolves evolved with. So. The thing that's been nice about that process is the four states that are involved, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, have had a very united front in terms of keeping the recovery effort within the historic range. We had a letter that was signed by all four governors that went to Sally Jewell and to the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and our congressional delegation is engaged, and through those efforts, I think we've been successful in pushing it back. For now, like I said, nothing's at the Federal Register yet. No official decisions have been made as of right now.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. We'll move on to item number 5 on the agenda, which is an action item. Following the presentation by Randy, we'll have an opportunity for questions and then also an opportunity for comments. If you want to make a comment, please fill out the comment cards. We have one up here so far. And with that, we'll turn the time to Randy.
Actually, Craig Walker.
Oh, excuse me. Craig.
Thank you.
There you go. You can start over now.
I know. See, I don't know how to work the mic. Chairman Black, council members, thank you for the opportunity tonight to present the results of our 2016 fishing regulation survey and our recommendations for fishing guidebook changes in the 2017-2018 guidebook series. I'd like to recognize Randy Opplinger, our cold water sport fish coordinator, in the audience. Randy and I are the ones that conducted the survey and put this presentation together for you tonight. I'd also like to acknowledge Richard Hepworth, the Southern Region Aquatics Manager, and he will be presenting the information specific to the Southern Region regulation changes later in this presentation. Three parts to the presentation tonight. The first part is informational items. As I mentioned earlier, the second part will entail angler survey results from our 2016 angler regulation survey. And the third part will discuss the proposed regulation changes we have for you for the 2017-2018 cycle. First informational item is our move to a two-year guidebook. We are going to a two-year cycle to assist the public and their understanding of our regulations. We feel that frequent rule changes are more difficult for the general public to track, and we'd like to have a two-year cycle to aid them in their understanding. Additionally, we see this as an opportunity for us to get in sync with our adjacent states, Arizona and Wyoming specifically, to allow us to begin moving forward with more consistent regulations at interstate waters that we have there in the form of Lake Powell and Flaming Gorge reservoirs. Another informational item, we have worked with Muskies Inc. to discuss tiger muskie management in the state of Utah, and we plan on working with them to possibly implement some changes or suggested changes next year. We will be surveying to assess the support for some of those suggested changes in the upcoming year. We have two management plans that were completed this year, the first of which is the Flaming Gorge management plan. The management objectives outlined in that management plan include the rainbow trout management objective of achieving greater than 0.35 fish per hour in our gill net catches. Lake trout, we want to achieve greater than 1.5 fish that are at least 28 inches in length per hour in our exploratory net catches. Burbot, we would like to knock that back to less than one fish per hour. As you all know, burbot are invasive in Flaming Gorge, and we're trying to reduce their abundance. We'd like to see them knocked back to less than one fish per hour in our gill net catches. For our kokanee salmon fishery, we would like to see at least 600,000 zero- to two-year-old kokanee in that reservoir, which we would assess using our hydroacoustic gear. And we would also like to prevent further invasive species introduction into that reservoir. The Jordan L management plan, again, the objectives are outlined here. The primary objective there is to enrich trophy angling opportunities. A concurrent objective is to promote a family fishery at that water. And we would also like to ensure a quality recreational experience for both boaters and anglers. We would like to manage Jordan L for compatibility with native species management in downstream areas. We would like to manage Jordan L as a destination fishery, have it be a destination for anglers both from within Utah and non-resident anglers. And we would like to, as with Flaming Gorge, ensure that no new species are illegally moved in or out of Jordan L. I'll now move on to the fishing regulation survey results and proposed regulation changes. In 2016, the DWR once again conducted an online survey to gather angler input on proposed regulation changes for the 2017-2018 cycle. This survey ran from May 11th through June 23rd of 2016. And although we did not collect information on the response rate for this particular survey, it is assumed that it is similar for to what we achieve for the rest of our surveys, which is right around 20%, 22% on average. This survey provides us, as it did last year for the first time, with input on the regulation changes for 2017-2018, and also gave us insight into other possible management questions that we have out there. The first of the questions that were putting forward to you tonight that was asked on the survey was involved the use of corn as bait. We asked 3,210 respondents if they would support the use of corn as bait. 70% of those respondents indicated that they would support the use of corn as bait, and 30% indicated that they would not support the use of corn as bait. One of the reasons why we asked this question is because you'll notice on this map up here, we are the only white state among the western states. The blue states allow the use of corn as bait. We are the last remaining state in the West that does not allow the use of corn as bait. Corn is in high demand for anglers, particularly targeting certain species, kokanee and carp being two of those species. It is cheap and easy to obtain and use for anglers. Historically, in Utah, the use of corn for bait was legal. However, due to concerns about chumming and excess litter at some waters in Utah, it was decided to make the use of corn illegal, and it has been illegal since that time. One of the concerns we have now as we move forward with the potential use of corn as bait becoming legal again is that same concern, chumming and littering related to use of corn. One thing that we try to avoid is redundancy in our laws. We already have laws that make chumming and littering illegal. We don't feel that just because corn is also going to potentially contribute to chumming and littering that it should be made illegal for that reason. We do recognize that there is a potential issue. Historically, as I mentioned, we did have issues with chumming and littering. And we also recognize that there's strong support for the use of corn as bait. And we're trying to approach this in a metered manner. We are therefore conducting a pilot study on the use of corn at kokanee and carp waters statewide, a select number of those. We polled each of our five management regions and asked them to put forward a kokanee water and a carp water for us to perform this pilot study on. What we're going to do is assess whether or not there are changes in the number of violations related to littering or chumming at these waters to assess whether or not corn is actually something that we want to move forward with as a bait throughout the state on a broader array of waters, or is something that we want to go back into the mode of making it illegal again if we end up seeing a lot of violations. Currently, the waters that we propose this regulation change on are Cutler Reservoir, Deer Creek Reservoir, Electric Lake, Fish Lake, Flaming Gorge, Lake Powell, State Line Reservoir, and Utah Lake. In the northeastern region, that was a statewide change, by the way. In the northeastern region, we had a question that went out regarding the use of burbot as cut bait at Flaming Gorge Reservoir. Of the 3,699 respondents to this question, 72% indicated that they would be supportive of the use of burbot as cut bait at Flaming Gorge Reservoir. 7% said no, and 20% indicated that they had no preference regarding the use of burbot as cut bait at Flaming Gorge. We also proposed the question, looking for whether or not the public would support the use of perch parts as a legal bait at Big Sand Wash and Red Fleet reservoirs. Of the 3,704 people that responded to this question, 65% indicated that they would support the use of perch parts as a legal bait at Big Sand Wash and Red Fleet. 9% said that they would not support this move, and 26% said that they had no preference. Based upon the public response to those questions, we plan on proposing that burbot be added to the list of cut bait at Flaming Gorge. We also propose that yellow perch eyes and parts be made available as bait at Big Sand Wash and Red Fleet reservoirs. An additional northeastern region question that was posed is, would the public support a regulation change at Bruff Reservoir that would allow the standard statewide limit of 4 trout and any legal bait? Currently, there is a special regulation at that water. It is managed as a trophy fishery. They have had a difficult time achieving trophy status at that water and feel that it would be more beneficial for the public to be able to catch more fish. That's why they're planning on liberalizing this and making it the 4 trout statewide limit. Of the 3,698 respondents to this question, 72% indicated that they would be supportive of a regulation change at Bruff Reservoir that would allow the statewide limit of 4 trout and any legal bait. 6% indicated that they would not be supportive of that change, and 22% indicated that they had no preference. Based on the public response, we plan to propose changing the regulation on Bruff Reservoir to the 4 trout possession limit, with all legal baits being permitted now at that reservoir. I'll now turn this over to Richard for a second. He's got some information on the southern region changes that were put forward in the survey.
All right, we just got a couple changes here that I wanted to make sure and talk to you about. The first one is Donkey Lake. If you're not familiar with where that's at, it's on the Boulder Mountain, kind of on that northeast corner. It's one of the fairly popular lakes on the mountain, especially with a lot of our anglers right there in Wayne County. When we did the management plan here a couple years ago, we identified Donkey Lake as one of those lakes we wanted to improve the size of the fish in the lake. And we talked about at that time doing a rotenone treatment to remove the brook trout that can reproduce and tend to stun out to some degree, which means there gets to be so many, there's not enough food for them to grow very big. We've had some opposition to that. We've got a few people that are concerned, not sure if they want us to do that. So, as we're working through some of those issues, and in an attempt to try a little bit different avenue to get the fish size up, we asked people if they'd support a 16-fish limit. Right now, it's a 4-fish limit up there. And one of their concerns was, they kept telling us, well, why don't you just let us go up and catch a bunch? That should help them grow better. So we're giving them the opportunity, or proposing that they get the opportunity to do that by this. And if you see here, 76% of the people supported that idea. So the other one was, the last couple of years at these RAC meetings, we've had some people show up to talk about lakes on what they call Cove Mountain. These are ones up above Glenwood Fish Hatchery up on that Monroe Mountain. It's the Big Lake, Deep Lake, and Annabelle Lake. We've been stocking those lakes for probably 40 or 50 years now. They don't overwinter. In fact, I don't know that we've ever seen fish survive the winter up there. So we get up there as soon as we can get a truck up there. We stock fish that are 8 to 10 inches long. They grow all summer. People have fun catching them. Whatever's left in the lake dies. So we had some people come and say, hey, what about letting us keep more fish at the end of the summer, doubling the limit, doing something to help us catch more of those out before it freezes and they all die. So what we did is we asked people if they would support doubling the limit after August 15th. And here again, it's right around 80%, 70 to 80% of the respondents said, yeah, we'd support that. So the two changes here in our region this year are, we're asking to increase the limit on brook trout at Donkey Lake to 16 fish, and then doubling the limit at Big Lake, Deep Lake, and Annabella from 4 to 8 starting August 15th each year. So...
Thanks, Richard. Moving on to the northern region, we will be removing seasonal closure for Cold Springs Lake, also known as Honeyville Pond. That's something that we're proposing. Currently, we have a walk and access agreement there that spans the entire year. Previously, it was only available for walk and access seasonally, which is why we had a seasonal closure on it. With access being afforded year-round, there's no need for a seasonal closure there any longer. Additionally, we propose that Smith Family Park in Far West be added to the list of community fishing waters. Moving on to the central region, this is one of the questions that came from the survey. The question asked if there was support for a 6-fish limit with no size restrictions at Jordan L Reservoir. Of the 3,705 respondents who answered that question, 61% indicated that they would be supportive of a 6-fish bass limit with no size restrictions at Jordan L. 11% indicated they would not be supportive of that change, and 28% indicated that they had no preference. From the plan for Jordan L that I mentioned earlier, the 6-fish smallmouth limit with no size restrictions actually addresses some of those objectives that we talked about earlier. It does potentially enrich the trophy angling opportunities at that reservoir. It makes Jordan L potentially a destination fishery for black bass anglers, and it ensures that no new species are illegally moved out of Jordan L because anglers are afforded a satisfying fishing experience at Jordan L and don't try to move those fish elsewhere. One other additional change that we're suggesting be made at Jordan L is the removal of the fillet restriction for smallmouth at Jordan L. Historically, you had to maintain a fillet on your smallmouth, maintain that skin so that they were recognizable. There were no filleting of fish at the water. We have, in the Jordan L management plan, indicated that we are trying to promote a family fishery. Any removal of restrictions on the filleting potentially allows us to make that more satisfying experience for family-oriented anglers, and ensures that a quality recreational experience is maintained for boaters and anglers at that water. We also suggest that the catch and kill regulation for northern pike be extended to Utah Lake tributaries, not just in the main lake itself. We suggest that Riverfront Pond be added to the list of community fishing waters. And those are the regulation changes that we're moving forward with. These responses outlined here were responses in the regulation survey to an open-ended question asking the general public what they would like to see us work on in the future, what potential regulation changes they would like to see, and just any general comments they would like to provide us with regarding the management of fisheries in Utah. And as you can see here, we're pleased to see that we were supported by many of the respondents. What we did is we looked at the overall list of responses to this open-ended question, which were approximately 1,500. We pared that down, and we took the top 10% of responses from those broad arrays of responses, and that's what's listed here. So the number one response that we got was that we're doing a good job. The second most popular response, coming in at 15%, was that we should increase the trout limit, and that varied from statewide to specific waters. Coming in at 11%, folks wanted us to improve bass management, black bass management in the state. Right around 10%, we were asked to increase our enforcement effort related to fishing in Utah. Similarly, around 10%, we were asked to increase the opportunities for fly and lure only angling in the state. We were also asked, as we progress down this list, to increase species diversity, increase access to private waters for anglers, remove slot limits, improve our community fishing waters, and last but not least, fix Schofield Reservoir, no matter what we need to do. So what we'll be doing is we'll be taking these responses here, and we'll be asking targeted questions in the same manner that we did this past year to aid us in the development of our suggested regulation changes for the 2019-2020 cycle. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity again to present this information to you. I'd just like to remind everyone here to share your ideas with the Division of Wildlife Resources. We conduct that survey every year related to potential regulation changes and just to gain general feedback from the angling public. We need your information by June 15th annually. Please share your ideas with your regional managers, specifically Richard right here. I'm sure would love to hear from you. And as we're doing tonight, please share your ideas at RAC meetings as much as possible. Or you can email your ideas to dwrcomment@utah.gov, or you can mail your ideas to Sport Fisheries Program Coordinator, Division of Wildlife Resources, P.O. Box 146301, and that will get to Randy or I so we can begin to address your questions and inquiries. We really appreciate the feedback and hope to provide you with satisfactory fishing experiences from this point forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Okay, Nick.
Could you be a little bit more specific on what the public might have meant by increasing bass management, improving bass management?
It was my job to lump the 1,500 responses into categories. It ran the gamut. We had individuals that felt that we needed more harvest. We had individuals that felt that we needed the increased use of slot limits specifically for black bass. We had individuals that felt that we needed to have a complete catch and release fishery in Utah for black bass. One thing that, you know, I as a fisheries biologist have learned, and anybody who's in our profession, there is no one size fits all. I think we have, oddly enough, in the second driest state in the nation, ample opportunity to provide a diverse array of opportunities and potentially address many of the concerns that were lumped into that one category.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. Good.
On the Utah Lake situation with the northern pike, and you want to extend it to the tributaries, is there a seasonal regulation on the tributaries?
There is currently, yes, there's a seasonal closure.
Would you oppose opening that up to 12-month fishing?
It depends on what the public's desire is. We aim to serve where it's biologically sound. So.
And I got one for Richard on the, the Big Lake, Deep Lake, Annabella Lake. Why December 31? Why don't you go a little bit further into ice fishing and stuff? Is that...
Generally, there's just really no ice fishing up there. And it's the end of the year when a new regulation book comes into effect, so it's easy just to set that as January 1st, so the next summer to start with. The people that asked us, the big thing was, is they wanted us to put the fish in early. They didn't want a lot of them harvested, so they had a chance to grow, and then they could harvest them right before it froze. Some years there might be a little ice fishing, but by January 1st, just access and the ice fishing up there is just non-existent.
Okay.
So.
I was sure that you had a good answer. So,
Braden?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions, and this is just for my own education. I've been to a whole lot of RAC meetings in my life, but this may be my first fishing RAC meeting. So I just have some questions that are probably easy answers to. But on the Jordan L Management Plan, one of your objectives was how do you ensure no illegal species? I guess I'm just wondering, what does that mean in the management plan?
There's several ways. What we're trying to do there specifically, as I mentioned tonight, was provide people with a satisfactory angling experience at that water, using sterile fish species in some instances. We're trying to minimize people's desire to move fish to other waters illegally by giving them the opportunities that they're looking for at existing fisheries.
Okay, so it would be addressing the fisheries near Jordanelle also then, so they aren't moving them, is that?
Correct.
Interesting, okay. Again, I said these just for my education, so the other one I was wondering about is prevent further invasive species introduction. My understanding is what we're primarily dealing with are the quagga mussels, and I'm just kind of curious, how effective is that per dollar spend? I see a lot of money going out, and I'm just interested on your response there.
These are hard questions, you guys. I would say that among the states that are conducting aquatic invasive species control efforts, we are, if you want to call us the premier state, we are the best at what we do in the aquatic invasive species realm. We have a dedicated staff, and I think that for every dollar spent, we actually get more than that dollar back. We have a small army of technicians, and they may be small, but they are mighty. They do a pretty good job.
So you would say it's an effective program. I just look at it and I think, man, it seems like a lot of effort, but if it's effective, that's great.
Right now, given the fact that we have an infested water within the state that is a destination water for pretty much all boaters in Utah at one time or another during the year, for us to have not had another finding other than Electric Lake, which was a suspect finding, is a testament to our effort.
Good.
For sure.
Braden, let me add to that. And Richard or Craig can add it. The effort's large because the risk is huge.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand what the potential consequences of quagga mussels spreading across the state is, you would think we needed to do even more than what we are. It's amazing to the level of hundreds of millions of dollars in the Great Lakes states that they're spending annually just to maintain water systems because of quagga mussels.
And I can spend more time researching that on my own, but thank you for your answer there. I'd be curious to know why other states aren't taking it as serious. Last question, and this one's an easy one. On the statewide changes for the corn, you said that you asked each region to come up with two bodies of water, and there's only eight bodies listed. I'm just wondering where the missing two are.
We have a shared water between two regions in Lake Powell. And then one of the other regions was unable to come up with a Kokanee water. Yep.
He's paying attention.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay. Do we have any questions from the audience? If so, please come to the mic in the center. We'll use that same mic for comments as well. Okay, I don't see any questions. Let's move on to comments. I have one comment card from the audience. If anybody else would like to comment, please fill out a card. This is Ken Strong with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife.
Turn your mic on, Ken.
Ken Strong with Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to stand here and talk to you guys. I've really had the pleasure with working with Mr. Walker and Randy and Drew Cushing with over some of these issues, and they've been true gentlemen, and we've worked a lot of things out. What I would like to address today, though, is the fishing regulations is corn. We approve or we accept basically all of the fishing regulations that the division has proposed, with the exception of corn. Corn was brought up basically because of carp and kokanee fishermen. And to give you an idea, kokanee are zooplankton eaters. They don't eat corn. You put corn on the end of a squid when you're trolling for them. It's for the color and the scent, which you can put anything really yellow back there, and you can buy corn scent in any of the sporting goods stores. Which would serve the same purpose. Otherwise, you can have corn. You get out in a boat, and I just want you to think realistically. You get out there, you open that 50-cent can of corn. You use a few kernels. You don't want to spill it in your boat. So what do you do with it? You dump it over the side of the boat. If you're coming back into the shore, or if you're on the shore, hopefully you'll pick up your can and throw it in the garbage can. Whether that happens or not is yet to be seen. But we're concerned about the use of corn in the state. It was outlawed because of the chumming and the littering, and we can see that coming back. Now, I know that there's all the states around us have corn that's legal. But does that mean we move in and follow them, or are we the leader? We know what it created in the past, and we need to look at that for the future. Now, if you're concerned or if you think we need to put corn on some waters, I would say we use Flaming Gorge because Wyoming allows corn, Lake Powell because you can chum down there as it is, and Utah Lake for the carp situation. But as far as kokanee goes, corn makes no difference. Second of all, we would like to make a proposal with the problem we have of people moving fish around the state. Northern pike got moved into Utah Lake. It's created a real mess down there, especially with the June suckers. And those fish spawn in the tributaries the same time as those tributaries are closed to fishing. And yet you're supposed to catch and kill all northern pike. So what we would like to see is those tributaries opened up to year-round fishing. Now, the reason they were closed in the first place was because of the walleye anglers. They didn't want to lose the walleye. Therefore, you turn around and put that walleye must be immediately returned to the water, just like we do with other fish on other waters. So thus, the walleye are protected, and yet we can harvest those northerns, which we need to do before it destroys a reservoir such as it did Yuba. Yuba used to have a great walleye fishery. It's gone. One time it had a good trout fishery, and it's gone. And they put perch in there. We fed perch for several years. We fed the pike perch for several years out of Fish Lake, which none of them survive. They all get eaten. Now, a third thing that's not on your paper that came up tonight, and I've been on the phone over this issue, the Northern Rack did pass it, and that's a two-day possession limit on strawberry. Strawberry and Flaming Gorge are the only two bodies of water in the state of Utah who do not allow a two-day possession limit. Many people are already doing it, thinking that it's a statewide issue. And I had agreed with a certain member at Strawberry to maybe back off a little bit, but as I look tonight with a two-year proclamation, that means it's going to be 2019 before it can be done. And like I say, Strawberry is the only complete body of water in the state of Utah that does not have a two-day possession limit. So I would urge you guys to consider Strawberry becoming a two-day possession limit to present to the board. This time, I just thank again for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate working with the division and these guys. They are really good to work with and really easy to work with. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. That's the only comment card that we have. Richard, would you mind talking to us a little bit about Strawberry and the possession limit?
Probably Drew or Craig.
Or somebody.
I want to come up. Strawberry's not in my region, so okay. I have a hard time with it. I will say that I have not seen any issues with the two-day possession limit in my region at any of our waters. First, I was concerned about Panguitch Lake and Otter Creek. Neither one of those seems to have been an issue.
We conducted the survey, and it was supported by the general public. We conferred with our regional biologist in the central region. He indicated that he would like one more year to examine this with anglers that have specific interests at Strawberry Reservoir, and we gave him that leeway.
Okay. Thank you. Rusty.
Randy, how is Strawberry doing right now? Your gill nets, are they meeting your objectives on the cups?
Strawberry is doing really well. It is not perfect. We're trying to hone that to become closer to perfect. We're in the midst of a three-year intensive monitoring effort to look at gill net results, conduct some different netting efforts, to conduct hydroacoustic surveying, similar to what we do at the gorge, to get a better handle on what the overall population structure looks like. I think that coming out of this three-year period of intensive monitoring, we're going to have a management prescription that's going to bring it back up to an even higher level than it already is as our top fishery in the state.
Can I ask you another question while you're still kind of up? And again, excuse my ignorance here. I'm not much of a fisherman.
Not a worry.
I've spent plenty of time behind a pole, but I don't catch anything. Richard, you made the comment that you haven't seen any issue with the two-day possession limit. Educate me again. I don't understand what issues you'd be looking for with that. What issues does it cause that you would be looking for?
The thinking is that if you liberalize regulations to allow for two-day possession, that you're actually going to impact the health of the fishery by over-harvest. What we've identified is the fact that increasing the possession limit has not changed the harvest of fish at these waters. People harvest what they harvest within the boundaries of what they need, and a two-day possession limit has not caused them to go out and seek, it has not increased their need to harvest.
Braden, just to correct you, it's a rod, not a pole. You build fences out of poles and you fish with rods. So.
Thank you.
The way I fish, it's a pole.
There you go. Doesn't move very much. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Any other comments? So let us summarize again from the comments that we did receive from SFW. They basically had an overall objection to the corn regulation, but if it is to be allowed, they suggested it be limited to only three bodies of water. That'd be Flaming Gorge, Lake Powell, and Utah Lake. The Utah Lake tributaries they'd like to see open year-round, but require that the walleye be returned. And then also they would like to add the two-day possession limit at Strawberry Reservoir. So those were the comments from them. You can include those in a motion. We could discuss them separately if that's something that we'd want to add or not. However you guys would like to move forward.
Dave, I've got one more question. I'm sorry.
Okay.
We're going to go through this meeting quick. Might as well make it longer. It seems like the only real issue from the public tonight is the corn. So I just have another education for me. One of the big concerns is chumming. And I understand it's a cheap bait, and you open the can, and I think what Ken said is probably exactly right. I'd probably be guilty of the exact same thing. I'd get done fishing, and I'd dump it in the water. And I guess I, in my ignorance, wouldn't assume if I'm dumping it because I'm leaving that that's chumming. I thought chumming was when you're going to fish over it. Is it a problem to dump it and drive away?
Dumping it and driving away, in my mind, would then be littering.
In the water?
I don't know. I
call it feeding. You're small fish.
I think that if you were to have a law enforcement person here, they would be able to give you a better answer than I can on that. I think it's a judgment call for them.
We have two law enforcement people in the back of the room there if they want to come down.
They can answer that question related to chumming.
They have their ticket book out, too.
I've never done it yet.
Okay, we have a question from Sean while they're coming down.
I'm just curious, since all the other states have been doing this for several years now, have you heard of any problems that have arisen there?
No.
I guess technically dumping anything like that into a water body would be considered littering. I don't know that my officers would be real inclined to issue a citation just from dumping a can of corn in. I think the cans themselves are more of the issue. Once you've got the empty can sitting there, it's pretty easy for that to be in the water as well. And from talking with Richard, some of the history on it, it sounds like the cans are more of the concern.
Yeah, just one other quick thing with that, because, I mean, I was a little kid when this changed, but I do remember some of it. And at that time, it wasn't just a can. When people load up their boat to head out on places like Panguitch Lake, for example, it was a whole case of corn that went with them. And all of that went overboard, and it was one can that they kept to fish with. So it was more a volume issue at that time. I don't see that being a big issue now. We've got just different fishermen than we had back then as well. So, you know, that's what it was. It was a volume thing, and you could literally see the cans littering the bottom of Panguitch Lake at that time. But I don't see that being an issue anymore. There's too many other good options out there.
Okay. More questions?
So I remember the chumming the corn. Does it not plug the fish up? Can they digest it? That was a big. That's what I thought they made it illegal for.
I remember growing up with that as well, and that was one of the reasons why my dad refused to let me fish with corn. Right now, there's no evidence to show that it's really impacting fish at all. So, recently, because there were concerns on Utah Lake related to the potential impacts to June sucker, which is an endangered fish, we actually conducted just some small feed trials with some June sucker that we have on station at the Fisheries Experiment Station. They actually refused to eat corn as if it were rocks. They spit it out. So. My boss says they may be smarter than trout. He doesn't know.
Most of you aren't old enough to know about corn, but whether I was fishing with corn or not, and we never baited with corn. We baited with cheese if there happened to be corn strung around in the water. And we used to pull out fish that, when you caught them and went to unhook them, squoze them, corn would just go everywhere. So it is easy to drop a little out there, and like you say, nobody wants to carry a open can of corn around all day. And if you have three extra fishing worms, when you're headed back in, they probably go in the water to feed the fish. The corn's going to do the same.
Okay. Anybody like to make a motion, or would you like to entertain these items separately?
I'd like to try a motion here. I'd like to make a motion to accept the division's recommendations with the exception of the corn. I think it should still remain illegal. And on the Utah Lake, open the tributaries to 12-month fishing. And if a walleye is caught, then it be immediately released back into the stream. With the water.
Okay.
pretty close. Oh, and then the strawberry two-day possession limit. I'd like to see that changed.
To 2 days?
To 2 days, yeah.
Okay. Do I have a second on the motion?
I'm almost there, Dave.
Okay. Let me read it one more time. To accept the division's recommendations with the exception of not allowing corn on any waters, that it remain illegal, and that we open the Utah Lake tributaries to 12-month fishing and add a two-day possession limit at Strawberry Reservoir. So we have a motion. Do we have a second? Okay. With no second, then the motion fails, dies, so I'll entertain a new motion.
Let me try. Because the division and the public have supported corn and showed, discussed that they haven't seen problems in other areas, I would propose to accept as recommended with the exception of the two-day possession limit on strawberry and the tributaries, that we open the tributaries around Utah Lake with an immediate release of walleye. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have a second? Okay. So we have a motion and a second by Dell. We have discussion on the motion.
Discuss so I have time to type. Come on, guys.
All those in favor? Hold them up so we can count them. Okay. All those opposed? So we have one opposed. You got the count?
So it passed. How many do we have here tonight?
We have eight.
So it passed 6-1? Passed 7-1?
7-1. Okay. That motion carries.
Can I just say, I'm going to start selling corn in a reclosable glass bottle. Anybody wants to join me in that business venture, we'll move forward.
Okay, our next agenda item is an informational item, and that'll be Kevin.
Well, it's really not me, but I'm going to introduce it. So Ben Lauder is here from the Utah Bowman's Association. They brought this proposal to the division, over the last little while. At this time, the division is neutral on the topic, but interested in getting some feedback through this process and maybe an additional process. But the Bowman's Association has a proposal on some ways to maybe make once-in-a-lifetime hunts with archery equipment a little more attractive or successful. I'm not sure. Maybe Ben will probably walk you through the reasoning, but we'll just turn the time over to him.
Thank you, Kevin. By way of introduction, my name is Ben Lauder. I'm the Vice President of the Utah Bowman's Association. I'm here tonight to present a proposal to you concerning archery-only opportunities for once-in-a-lifetime species. For a little bit of background, where this is coming from, over the last several years, I've had many of my membership ask me why we don't have archery-only opportunities for once-in-a-lifetime species. I don't know that I've ever really been able to give them a sufficient answer. So earlier this year, my board of directors tasked me with forming a committee to investigate archery-only once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. I did so. Our committee consisted of five individuals, myself included. Over the last couple months, we've met as a committee multiple times, and a few of us from the committee have also met with various leaders and game managers from the DWR, and this proposal is what we've come up with to this point. So what we're looking to do is provide an archery-only hunt experience for once-in-a-lifetime species. Wow, can we resize that? So what is this? But before I get into what it is, I want to tell you what it's not, because this question has already been posed to me tonight, actually, before we even started the meeting. What this is not is this is not a way for the bow hunter to draw a once-in-a-lifetime species tag faster. Right? This does not create new hunts. It does not change the draw process. It does not change any drawing odds. And let me explain how that is the case. So what this is, what we are proposing, is that when a person draws a once-in-a-lifetime species tag through the current draw process and the current hunt structures, that they would be given two options. Option one would be the default. They wouldn't have to do anything, keep the tag as is, hunt the current season dates as we know them today with their choice of weapon, you know, rifle, muzzleloader, archery equipment, and they could continue to do that. Option number two is to provide the hunter with an option to exchange the tag for an archery-only permit with new season dates that are archery-only season dates. So this is a general idea of what those season dates would look like, what we're recommending. I'll go through them each species, starting with moose. Actually, before I get into each species, you'll notice that these archery-only season dates, depending on the species, could be a season prior to the current season, could be a season after the current season, or it might be a combination of the two. So starting with moose, we're recommending a 7-day season prior to the current any weapon season, as well as a 21-day season after. The reason we didn't want to go more than 7 days is we want to be sensitive on the moose. We understand that that's a fairly easy animal to harvest, and we don't want to give too many days in the front of the current offering where other hunters that don't have an interest in the archery would feel that there's an unfair advantage there. On bison, we're recommending 21 days before the current hunt season dates. On mountain goats, we're recommending 10 days prior to the current season, 14 days coinciding with the last 14 days of the current season, and I'll explain that in a little bit more depth on the next slide, and then 7 days after the current season. And then on desert and Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, we're recommending a 21-day season after the current any weapon season. So what would these season days look like today if this were in place today? If this were in place today, these are 2016 dates. On moose, we're recommending September 10th to the 16th. I would point out that that is overlapping the current archery deer and elk hunts. And then another season after the current season of October 21st to November 10th. The reason we're splitting that up, again, we want to be sensitive to not give too many days ahead and then some days after. But we don't want to go too far into November because moose shed really early. We don't want to be selling tags for moose that don't have antlers anymore. On bison, on Antelope Island, we're recommending no change because Antelope Island is kind of its own unique deal there, which leaves the Henry Mountains and the Book Cliffs bison herds, bison hunts. And you'll notice that there's various season-ending dates going into December and even January, and so a post-season doesn't really make much sense there. And so we're recommending an early season of October 1st through the 21st. And I want to point out that that ends before the limited entry deer hunt on both of those units. We want to be sensitive to those deer hunts, those limited entry deer hunts, so we're not interfering with those. On the mountain goats, we're recommending 10 days prior to the current season. And then you'll notice on the current season dates, there's depending on the unit, they end on different dates, some of them in October, some of them in November. And the reason that those dates vary so much, as I've talked to Justin Shannon about this, is those dates are generally or typically set to coincide with Forest Service road closures. And that is why we're recommending on the post-season the 14 days to coincide with the current hunt so that we're not getting too late in. So we're given some opportunity there for the archer that chooses this option to hunt later in the season but before those roads close. Then on desert bighorn sheep, we're looking at November 10th through the 30th. And then Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, looks like I need to update my slide, but 21 days after. I believe that would be a December season, if I remember right, on that species. All right, so what are the benefits of this? Why would we want to do this? This provides an archery-only hunt experience for those who would choose to partake in it. Essentially, what this does is allows an archer who is decided and determined they want to take a once-in-a-lifetime species with a bow, and they're not interested in taking it with anything else. This gives them the opportunity to hunt in the field without a rifle hunter, without the thought in the back of their mind of another hunter coming in and essentially shooting over the top of them or shooting an animal out from underneath them. Another benefit is the more archers that would partake in this option would obviously reduce the hunters during the current season. Thus, you know, it could be a benefit to those who aren't interested in the archery because there would be less competition during their season as well. And then, again, I want to point out this doesn't affect the current draw process. Draws are not affected. It does not create any new hunts. Not a way for the bow hunter to get in line sooner. All right, a couple of discussion items. This first top one, this is most specific to the sheep units, the sheep hunts. We're aware that, and I've discussed this with Justin, the DWR typically does their aerial surveys shortly after the current season, the current hunting season. And so we're aware of that, and we just want to point that out, that the hunter would need to be made aware that if they chose this option on a sheep hunt, there's a really good chance that the DWR would potentially be flying, and they may get flown over during their hunt, and that's you know, a risk that would come with that hunt. Again, Forest Service road closures, that's mostly pertaining to the mountain goat hunts, and towards that end of the season, access could get limited. On the Pilot Mountain unit, sheep unit, there's some interstate hunt agreements, so we're not recommending any changes there. And then again, on the Henrys and Book Cliffs rifle deer hunts, the bison hunts that we're recommending would not interfere or overlap those at all. And then also the last thing, when you got people hunting with a bow, obviously there's a potential for lower success rates. All right, thank you very much for the opportunity to present this. I'd be happy to entertain questions, and of course I'm looking for any feedback that you may have.
Okay, do we have any questions from the rack? Bill?
So just to be clear, the archery-only hunts would be prior and after, but if you had that tag, you couldn't hunt during with archery tackle during the regular season, right?
That is correct, yes. You'd essentially give up that season.
Okay.
It would be, it'd be a trade. You're giving up that season, giving up the opportunity to hunt with a rifle or muzzleloader for the archery-only seasons and the archery tag.
Well, I just want to make sure that if you had that tag, I guess, if you couldn't still only use archery tackle during that season, but you're giving up that right for that middle season.
That's correct. That's what we are proposing. And that's what I'm here to gain feedback on. Is this something that seems acceptable? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Are there ways to tweak it? Yeah, give me any feedback you've got.
Rusty, do you have a question?
Just clarification. So you're going to draw a rifle tag the once in a lifetime the normal way, but then you'll have the option to turn that in.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Okay. Nick?
Is it a big problem with rifle hunters shooting over archery hunters? Is that something that's major problem? I'm just curious.
I don't know that it's a major problem. I mean, it's a possibility, you know, and you know, when you're hunting with a bow, the stock situation is different, and it varies from species to species, but you know, you start talking like a mountain goat or sheep that live in, you know, very, very difficult country, it could take a bow hunter, you know, a long time to you know, possibly even wait for the animal to get into a position where it can be stalked to within bow range, whereas, you know, an archer might be waiting for that opportunity, and on a sheep hunt, that might take a day or two, and whereas a rifle hunter could come in and you know, to get 300 or 400 yards is much easier than, you know, 30-40 yards, and can be done much quicker.
Braden?
Are you ready for comments or
questions? Both.
It's Mike. I have a couple comments here.
trying to represent the, or being on the RAC and trying to represent sportsmen in general, I don't see a big concern as far as the idea of this, because our once in a lifetime, we expect or would like 100% harvest. It's not like deer hunting where if we had 100% harvest, it'd be catastrophic. So this is just more opportunity. I guess my comment would be, I would be very much like to see us extend the season dates of all once in a lifetime to the maximum amount we can to allow these hunters to hunt when they can. That's a general comment. My additional comment with this is, again, I don't see any issues with this at all, other than I don't understand why archery hunters would need to give up the regular dates also if they want to hunt with a rifle and those additional dates. Again, we're looking for 100% harvest. To me, it seems like an easy solution, or an easy opportunity. That's the right word. Additional opportunity.
So if I understand what you're suggesting, then, is rather than a trade for an archery-only tag, just add an archery-only season that anybody with that drew that tag could.
Well, I guess my first thought is if these dates are available to hunt. Now, you did have a couple dates that overlapped into the archery hunt. That would make total sense to have archery-only tags. But like on the sheep units, why can't we just already extend those dates for everybody so we can hunt longer and spread out pressure? So my comments maybe not so much in favor of the archery idea, although I think any time we can extend opportunity and on a hunt where we're expecting 100% success, that should be our goal, is to extend opportunity. So I think there's room to discuss this further, absolutely.
Sure.
Okay. Anybody else? I guess I'm sure all this would get flushed out, you know, as this moves along too. But my question might even be for Steve, that understands the bison a lot better than I do. But right now there's three hunts for bison. This would put another hunters in the field even earlier. So essentially there's four hunts for bison, and they seem to want to leave certain areas and get moving out of the country to somewhere else. So I don't know how that would affect the quality of that hunt, but I'm sure, you know, people that understand the bison better than me, or that'd be discussed as it moves through a normal rack process. But
yeah, if there's somebody that's an expert on bison, I'd love to hear from them as well. As we've discussed this, and with Bill Bates, who knows bison fairly well, the idea was archers hunting in October. Once the shooting starts with a rifle, yeah, they move quite a bit. We don't believe that chasing them with a bow is going to move them that much. But, yeah, Steve, I'd love to hear what your comments on that.
Yeah, I agree. I think we'd be just fine with archery equipment. If you go out there and start shooting again, that's different. But I don't think that would cause an issue.
What about with sheep, Donnie? You understand sheep pretty well. Do you see any conflicts that way? Okay.
Dates would be after the regular dates anyway.
Oh, okay. Great.
So they'd already be scared.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Gene.
Now, sometimes the DWR throws in a antlerless once in a lifetime on goats and bison, and they usually put a different date on it, so that might foul up your dates, might foul up that, or that might foul up your dates a little bit as far as the going for antlerless, or not antlerless, heck, they all got them, but going for female goats and cow buffalo. They sometimes those dates are an added hunt.
Sure. So we've taken those dates into account. As you can see on bison, those, if I recall correctly, the cow bison hunts on the Henrys are those December 3rd to the 16th and December 17th to the 31st dates. So my vision is the way this would work. If you drew a bison tag, whether it's a bull tag or a cow tag, and you want that you would have the option to trade it, and so essentially you could potentially have in that October 1 to 21 season somebody hunting on a cow tag or a bull tag, and they could be, you know, they'd be hunting together potentially. I don't see that as an issue, and we've taken those dates into account.
Okay, great. Appreciate it. Very interesting.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, our last agenda item tonight is the Lake Powell Fishery Management Plan by Richard.
All right, thanks again. Appreciate the opportunity to stand up here and talk to you about some of this. You know, you've heard a little bit about some other management plans as we went through the regulation stuff. This is a similar one that we put together and did. We actually completed this plan. You know, it's been even almost a year, maybe even a little more than a year ago. But because of some things they asked us to do in that plan, we really weren't able to finalize it until just recently. But I'll talk about that. I'm going to keep most of this pretty brief. I think hopefully all of you received a copy of the plan. And if you've got some more in-depth questions later, if you've had a chance to think about things, feel free to contact me and we can talk about it then too. This is the committee we put together. It was based on some questionnaires we put out, some surveys we put out, and then we tried to, one of the hard parts when you're dealing with a lake like Lake Powell is involving all the agencies, stakeholders, and everybody that's involved down there. So pretty big list of people from National Park Service to Glen Canyon Adaptive Management Group, Arizona Game and Fish. We had somebody from the Navajo Generating Station. That's the big power plant you see there. And a bunch of different anglers. So the only thing I want to mention on this list is we didn't have this particular plan signed by every one of these members. And part of the reason for that was is the National Park Service, right from the start, told us they could not be a signatory on any plan that didn't go through their federal process. They were involved in the discussions. They were involved in talking about what we were doing, but they weren't a signature. So we didn't ask anybody to sign up, but we did have really good cooperation and good feedback from everybody on developing this plan. So the purpose of the plan, and this is what we went to the group and said, this is what we want your help so we can develop. The first thing was just to provide input for the development of a Lake Powell fisheries management plan. So we weren't going to talk about motor boating. We weren't going to talk about water levels. Those are things that weren't part of this. We wanted to just talk about what was going on under the water with the fish. We asked them to put together a mission statement, set goals and objectives, specifically measurable objectives, ones that we can go back and say, yes, we're doing a good job, no, we need to do some work on. Make some recommendations how to achieve those goals, and consider all the interests that we have around the table and those that you know of that maybe not around the table, so we can find that common ground and do something that everybody can be happy with. So this was the mission statement. I'm going to go ahead and read it. It's the best way to go through it. And it's to adopt an aquatic resource management plan that will provide management agencies direction to, one, maintain a quality, sustainable sport fishery, two, ensure all actions are compatible with native species, and three, reduce the impact of recent and future aquatic invasive species infestations. So we talked about this a little bit earlier. Quagga mussels have shown up and are expanding quite rapidly in Lake Powell. We know that's going to have some kind of an effect on the fishery. We don't know exactly what it's going to do to the fishery, but we know it's going to change it. So that's what initiated us to put this plan together, is go in and be prepared for these changes, do what we can to maintain a quality fishery there. So these were the seven goals they outlined in the plan. I'll talk about some of these in just a little bit more depth. But the first one, they wanted to maintain the current fishery for as long as possible. In our surveys and talking to these people around the table, everybody loves what we have down there. They don't want to see it change. They understand most likely it's going to, but they wanted us to maintain it for as long as possible. And they were very clear this was the most important thing we could do. The second thing was to adjust the fish assemblage as forage changes due to the mussel impacts on the food web. These mussels in the lake are so prolific and will get so thick in there that they'll end up cycling the water in the entire volume of water in Lake Powell like every 8 hours. And what they do is they clean out that microscopic food that the little fish and the shad depend on to eat that feed the bigger fish. So at some point we're going to have some kind of a change in that food web. Could be a collapse. It's going to change it. But they wanted us to keep an eye on that and make any adjustments that we saw needed to be done based on that. Part of that, they wanted us to maintain angler satisfaction and use. Minimize the negative impacts to native species. Minimize impacts of the aquatic invasive species. They wanted us to do additional public outreach. And they outlined some research needs we needed to do. And that's kind of where this got delayed a little bit. So as I'm going to go through each one of these or some of these objectives that are the goals I just laid out and just give you a little more detail on how that was set up. But maintain the current fishery. They said the way to measure this and see if you're doing a good job is to maintain the overall catch rate of one fish per hour. In the surveys we do down there, that's about what we average for our anglers. They catch about one fish per hour on average year-round at the lake. Maintain our angler use at about 200,000 angler days per year, which equates to about 800,000 angler hours. In the past 15 years, we varied from about 2 million angler hours down to about 500,000 at our low. And a lot of that just is what cycle we're in with the stripers down there. And then they outlined a bunch of species-specific objectives that I wasn't going to go into here, but largemouth bass, they wanted specific catch rates, specific sizes, same with stripers, walleye, etc. This was the big one, and this is kind of the kicker that's going to get messy down the road at some point, and that's why we decided to bring this through the RACs as an action item and through the Wildlife Board. And that's where it's evaluating stocking additional fish that might be able to use these quagga mussels. Lake Powell and the water leaving and coming into Lake Powell, we have seven different states that if we put a fish in Lake Powell, it could affect fish management, native species in seven different states because of the connectivity there. So it's one of these things that's going to take some real political savviness to get something, introduce something in there that everybody's going to be okay with. So one of the fish they looked at and said they want us to evaluate is this red ear sunfish. It's down in Lake Havasu. It's growing to some exceptional sizes, and it's really feeding on these mussels. It doesn't control them, but it's able to utilize them. So we did a big risk assessment. We looked at that. One of the things we found with that is they're very similar to bluegill, which we already have in the lake. So what we've determined, and this kind of finalized this plan for now, is we're going to conduct a 3 to 5 year study to evaluate the bluegill that are already in Lake Powell to figure out how they're utilizing these mussels and if they're going to fill that same niche that red ear might. If they fill the same niche, introducing another fish that's that similar isn't going to make any difference. If they're not filling the niche, they're not utilizing the mussels like we think they need to be, then it may be time to introduce the red ear. And that's what this study that we're going to start real soon is going to tell us. So that's kind of the big part of this whole plan that we want your guys' approval on more than anything. Moving on, maintain angler satisfaction. Currently, we have about 75% of our anglers that say, you're doing an awesome job, everything's good, everything's wonderful down at Lake Powell. That's what they want us to try and maintain, is about that level of satisfaction down there. Minimize negative impact to native species. A couple of things we've got going on down at Lake Powell right now. Walleye populations are expanding, and they're moving up the Colorado River. They're causing problems for some of the native and endangered species there. So a couple things we're going to start doing there. One, we're going to start to evaluate this walleye moving out of the lake. Is there anything we can do to stop them from moving up the Colorado, up the San Juan, causing those problems? At the same time, we initiated a walleye tagged fish contest. The purpose of that contest was, one, to get people more excited about catching and harvesting walleye down at Lake Powell, and to get those people that don't know how to catch walleye, teach them how through reports and information, just get them down there doing it. So that's underway right now. Started in July, and it'll go through until next July. And with that, I'd entertain any questions from you guys.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the rack? Gene?
Do you have any red ear sunfish in the state at this time?
I think we do, up in a community pond that showed up in one of our stocking trucks. Is that correct? It's kind of a hitchhiker species that we really didn't want, but they are in a pond in the Salt Lake Valley.
Okay.
Just to clarify, just so you guys know, that picture on the right is a red ear sunfish. I think that's the current world record that was caught down in Lake Havasu maybe 2 years ago.
8 pounds or something, Richard? How big was that?
I think it's just over 3 pounds, 3.5 pounds. So it's a great big bluegill is really what they look like.
5 pounds?
Oh. 5 pounds, they're correcting me. So it's even bigger than I told you. That's okay. Where the excitement comes from for Lake Powell. That's why we're getting some pressure to try them there.
Do we have any questions in the audience? Okay, Ken? Remember to state your name for us.
Ken Strong, sportsman from Fish and Wildlife. Richard? With the red-eared sunfish, and I may be getting led astray a little bit, but from what I have read on the internet, some of these red-eared sunfish have reached the size of up to 8 pounds in Lake Havasu. Now, I could be wrong. Will the bluegill eat the quagga mussel? And if they do, will they grow big like this, or is that an unknown?
They will eat. We've already found evidence that bluegill at Lake Powell are eating mussels. We don't know how their population and their size is going to change because of mussels, and that's what we're going to monitor, and that's what we're going to watch over this 3 to 5 year study.
So you're going to wait till this study's done before you consider the red-eared?
Yes. We're going to do that first, and then at that point, at the end of this study, we're going to make a decision. Do we need to introduce red-ear or do we not?
Good question. Anybody else? Gene?
Do you think it's likely that somebody will haul some up from Lake Havasu before the 3 to 5 year study's over?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Okay. I don't have any comment cards from the audience. Do you have any comments from the rack? I'm ready to entertain a motion then. Go ahead.
I'm not shy. I make motion we accept the proposal as presented.
Thank you. Do you have a second? And we have a second from Rusty. Any discussion? All those in favor? Looks unanimous. Okay. The last business that we have is deciding where we're having supper tonight. So with that, we'll call this meeting adjourned.